MacCast, Sunday, February 18th, 2018. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, hey, we've got a pretty good show for you today. Not a whole lot going on, but we have a few things to talk about. For one thing, don't yank your HomePod's tail. I'll tell you what that means. We'll also get into a little more HomePod things because others have gotten inside the HomePod. Yeah, HomePod teardowns have happened. We know a little bit more details about the internals and just some little more information in general now that the HomePod has been out in the wild for a little while. We're going to talk about possible changes to how Apple rolls out the operating system updates in the future. Numbers look good for Apple laptops. They have some gains there. We're going to talk about that. Also, another week has gone by. And of course, you know, that means some new Apple TV show to talk about, original content. You're going to get into some of that, a possible new messaging bug. And then we have some of your feedback, including more iOS remote support tips and tricks, more information about Apple battery replacement program and some troubles some folks have been having there and how you might be able to avoid those troubles, plus just a whole lot more really, really cool stuff. So should be fun. Hang on. We're going to jump right into it. No delay. Starting off with that HomePod cable, the tail I was telling you about. Don't pull on your HomePod's tail. It's not really going to like it. I think we talked about the fact that a few people have discovered that the power cord on the HomePod does come out. If you yank on it hard enough, it will pop out. It makes a horrible sound. I advise you not to do it yourself. And actually, Apple is apparently telling folks the same thing. An internal document distributed to Apple stores and Apple authorized service providers says that actually pulling the cable out of your HomePod, the power cable, could actually cause damage to the internal speaker components, so it does not advise doing that. What's odd about that to me is the fact that it does come out and it does seem to have a connector, so I'm assuming in the service manual for the HomePod there must be some approved way of maybe detaching it, but at the very least, Apple says consumers should not be pulling that out, and it sounds like even Apple authorized service providers or folks at the Apple retail store shouldn't be doing that. The guide also says that if the cable does become somehow detached from the HomePod, that you should not attempt to plug it back into yourself because that could possibly cause damage. They say you'll need to send it into Apple for a repair. Also, if the cable becomes damaged for some other reason, say your pet chews on it and destroys it, then and it needs to be replaced, the cost to do that to you will be $29 US, and that's even without AppleCare Plus. So that's the out-of-warranty cost. So it will always cost just $29 to replace the power cable, but you are going to have to send it in. Of course, this assumes that there's no other internal damage caused to the unit itself and that it's just the cable that needs replacing. So don't mess with the power cable on your HomePod. Just let Apple deal with that and you should be fine. Some other things that have happened with HomePod this week. You may have heard the audiophile review of the HomePod. Well, just like I've always said, don't always believe everything you read. A bunch of sites kind of picked up on something that was posted in an audiophile subreddit. Basically, one reviewer did a review in his house and concluded that the HomePod could match a pretty high-end set of reference audiophile speakers, and he had a bunch of numbers and figures and things like that to back this up. But almost immediately after his report went up on the subreddit, and after, unfortunately, a lot of sites had sort of reposted the fact that the HomePod could match audiophile level speakers, it was disputed a little bit by some others in that community, specifically saying that really you can't make those conclusions because you have a room bias going on. You cannot do those kinds of high-end audiophile tests inside just a standard room, which is what this guy did. These kinds of tests really need to be done in an anechoic chamber, which is exactly how Apple tests them. They have a bunch of these rooms, and a bunch of them were featured, actually. They invited press in to take a look at them. These are the same chambers they use for testing iPhones and basically all their audio products. They're really noise isolating. They isolate vibrations from the floor. They're just really expensive high-end rooms, and that's how you really need to perform these tests. So even though he was using some pretty high-end equipment, some of the conclusions that were being drawn really aren't very accurate. Another one that was pointed out in this piece was that he had said the HomePod demonstrated a flat frequency response, and it was noted that, well, depending upon the scale, any sort of frequency response could be flat. And the person who was calling this into question pointed out that his chart used a 10 dB scale, which in the realm of audio, 10 dBs is pretty big. If you put it on a 1/12th octave scale, well, then you could see that it wasn't nearly as flat a frequency response. But even that didn't matter because, again, you have a bunch of things going on in the room that influence that. So he wasn't necessarily saying, no, you know, it's totally invalid. You can't, you know, that the HomePod doesn't meet standards for a audiophile type speaker, just that for these particular tests, you cannot draw that conclusion because it wasn't done in the right kind of testing environment. As we know, overall, most reviewers who have listened to the HomePod have given it pretty favorable reviews. And as a matter of fact, Fast Company, just as a comparison, they also tried to do a similar room test. They had a professional hardware and software audio maker, NTI Audio, come in and do the tests, and they found that there was an average variance of 0.95 decibels across all audio frequency bands in their audio tests, which again seemed to validate the flat claims of that Reddit piece. But once again, they were not in the ideal testing environment, so it's really hard to kind of draw some of these conclusions beyond the fact that it does appear and look like the HomePod is a really high-end, at least audiophile level speaker. Apple would have you believe that. But again, until we start seeing some tests that were also done in anechoic chambers by other reviewers, then we really can't draw some of these big conclusions that some places are trying to draw. Now, that said, I still absolutely love the sound of my HomePod, but again, sound is very subjective. So not everyone is going to feel the same way. And I've talked to many of you who have written in to say you went and listened at an Apple store and it just wasn't the speaker for you. And it certainly is not going to be for a lot of people. It does have a strong bass presence. It's not heavy and overpowering, in my opinion, but that is a sound that some people aren't really comfortable with. So we're starting to get a lot of these reviews, a lot of them very positive, but I wanted to talk about some of the more of the reviews that are a little bit more on the critical side. And as a matter of fact, Consumer Reports this week came out and they don't agree with most of the HomePod reviews. They rated the Google Max, which is a little bit more expensive than the HomePod, and the Sonos One as having better sound. In their tests, they supposedly use a dedicated listening room in their tests and have experienced testers who are comparing these things against a reference set of very high quality speakers. And they gave the HomePod a very good rating. They said it is going to be a speaker that is appealing to a lot of people. But in their tests, and their reviewers said that they felt the bass was, quote, boomy and overemphasized. And they called the mid-tones somewhat hazy with treble that was underemphasized. I would tend to agree with the bass being a strong presence. The words boomy and overemphasized, I don't get that, at least to my own ears. And as far as mid-tones and treble, I've been okay with mine. One odd thing in their review is they said that the HomePod was a little bit quote-unquote muddy versus the Sonos One speakers. And in my own experience, although I only have Play ones, not the newer Sonos ones, when I was doing my testing, I would say almost more that the Sonos, in my opinion, was a little bit more muddy. Or I think, as I mentioned in the last episode of the MacCast, it had more of this hollow presence to it, where it almost sounded like it was in a performance hall. It just, that it wasn't right up front. It didn't feel to me like the sound was right there in front of you. So that was my personal experience, but Consumer Reports, sort of didn't agree with a lot of the other reviewers that the HomePod was a really great sounding speaker. Another review that had come out that was doing a quote-unquote blind listening test, and actually one of the only tests where I saw a reviewer doing it blind, so much credit goes to David Pogue for trying this. He had a bunch of people come in and test the HomePod versus a Google Home Max, a Sonos One, and an Amazon Echo. And he hid all of the speakers with, A, B, C, and D labels behind a curtain, and then played for the listeners from a range of different backgrounds the same tracks on those units, streamed all over his Wi-Fi, all from the Spotify app. And overall, they found that two of their reviewers preferred the sound of the Google Home Max. They thought that was the best. And the other three picked the Sonos One speakers as being the best. None of them actually picked the HomePod. And, you may find that interesting. But one thing I wonder about his tests, and he did point this out, he mentioned that the volume on all of the units really needs, it's really critical that the volume of the stuff that you're playing back is all at the same level. And something I discovered in my HomePod testing was that when I played music over AirPlay, which is what you would have to use to play Spotify, in general, the HomePod, when playing AirPlay sources, is a lot softer. The audio comes in at a much lower volume, but Pogue supposedly calibrated the night before all of the speakers to get them as near as he could tell with his ear at the same volume level, so that's good. But I do have to wonder if the audio going over AirPlay to the HomePod just isn't quite up to snuff as the stuff that you play directly, and especially since it's still AirPlay 1, it's supposedly going to get a lot better with AirPlay 2. That technology just isn't here yet. So that's one thing in his tests that I do wonder about. But probably the more critical thing in his tests, and something that I don't think he thought about, was the fact that he put a curtain in front of all of the speakers. And as many of you probably know, the HomePod has some pretty sophisticated technology in it, including its beamforming technology that is analyzing the music in real time that is coming out of the speakers and detecting what kinds of things are in the room. It does an initial calibration, but as music is playing, it's my understanding it also does some additional calibrations to figure out what's going on. So if it has a certain audio coming back at it, maybe from bouncing off a curtain, or maybe if it's diffusing through the curtain in a certain way, it's probably adjusting the sound of the HomePod to react to that, which could negatively impact its performance, especially in this kind of test. If the speaker had been moved at all after the curtain was in place, it could even be worse because it would recalibrate itself and it could think that it was actually sitting right behind a wall and focus all of the sound away from the listeners. So I do have to wonder in his tests if maybe that wasn't a factor in the HomePod's performance. So again, there's a lot of things to think about here. Ultimately, I think for most people, my advice is you really can't go solely off of a review that you hear from a third party. Again, because what you hear and the sounds that you like and you prefer are going to be very different. Unfortunately, an Apple retail store probably isn't the best environment to test a HomePod in, but it may be the only option for a lot of people, at least maybe until these get out into other retailers. It'd be nice if Apple had some sort of listening room you could go into, but that's not really a possibility. But at the very least, if you're considering spending $350 on a HomePod, which is a significant investment, don't trust my opinion, don't trust the opinions of any reviewers. Go in and listen to one for yourself and see if it's something that you are going to like and enjoy. Fortunately, Apple does have its 14-day return policy, so you could also just pick one up, try it out in your home, see if it's going to work for you, and if you don't like it, return it. And there's nothing wrong with that. There is going to be plenty of people who don't prefer the sound of the HomePod. And what's great is that some of these other speaker systems, the Google Home Max, I've heard really great things about, and certainly I am a fan of the Sonos products. I have a Sonos home theater system, and I absolutely love it. My HomePod's not going to be replacing that. I'm going to have both living in my house. So you should go with the thing that you think is best and works best for you. And Sonos supports the other music services. It supports some of the other assistants and will eventually, according to Sonos, support HomeKit and Siri. And I hope that happens someday. So that may be the best option if you want a great sounding speaker system that is totally open. But if you're living in the Apple ecosystem, and you're 100% in like I am, I think the HomePod is a great choice. HomePod was also tore down this week by iFixit. They got in there and we got our first look at how Apple put these things together. And the quote from iFixit is, "This thing is built like a tank." As a matter of fact, looking at the teardown, it was a bit gruesome because they had to resort to a hacksaw to actually open the thing up. So there's a few layers going on here that are interesting to think about. You have the outer coating, which is the really spongy fabric that Apple has put together. That's actually held down with a very sophisticated drawstring mechanism, but it's not really obvious at first. So they ended up cutting into it before they discovered, oh, if you actually pull the screen off the top, which has a lot of adhesive, you have to kind of heat it up. But once you get under there, there is a drawstring mechanism, and you can loosen that, and then the whole fabric layer simply slides off what is essentially a giant plastic shell, which is a little bit surprising to me because you have the fabric all the way around. You would think there's like that's to let sound out all the way around. No, there's actually little ports in different key areas, including along the bottom for the tweeters and out the top for the woofer. You've got a bunch of vents, and then on the sides, just little tiny slots for the microphone holes, and then everything else is really solid plastic. And what they couldn't figure out was any way to kind of get either of the ends of that plastic off. It looks like at some point Apple may have included a kind of screw system, so a lot of the components seem like they can actually be screwed out of the cylinder itself, but actually getting into the cylinder isn't really obvious. And until somebody leaks one of the HomePod repair manuals, it's not really clear what can be done. And maybe you can't get in there at all. There's certainly a lot of adhesive in there. The whole thing seems to be glued together. And if you look at Apple's repair cost for a HomePod that is out of warranty, it's $279 US, which is not far off of the full price of a replacement for the HomePod. So they may just be actually replacing these things and not even thinking about trying to get in there and repair them, at least not very easily. But a few other things that were interesting from the iFixit teardown. Under the little rubber foot on the bottom, they discovered this really interesting 14-pin connector. Almost like the little diagnostic connector that is on, you know, like a larger version of the little diagnostic connector that is on your Apple Watch. And they do think that this is, once again, since it's so hard to get into the internals, they're probably there for technicians to be able to do various diagnostic tests by simply, you know, putting leads or tapping on those pin connectors so they can get in there and maybe analyze and see what might be going on inside before they have to break out the big gun tools and actually tear down and get in there. Also, very interestingly, the tweeters, the seven tweeters that are in there, or is it seven or six? I can't remember, but they're all in these little tiny pods that actually have little horns on them that focus the sound down and out through holes in the bottom of the HomePod. And a couple reviews even mentioned that you may be able to get a little bit better sound out of your HomePod by lifting it up off the table, you know, putting it on something that lifts it off of the surface, the table surface just a little bit. Now, I wonder, though, if that's really something you want to do and how that may affect the sound, because I'm assuming since these things are pointed down that Apple has accounted for that in terms of where the foot is, how much that rubber lifts the speaker off the surface, which is just a few millimeters, and it may be actually enhanced for that configuration. So I would debate that a little bit, but a few reviewers have said that that would be a good thing to do. I've played around with mine. I have it up on a stand right now. I'll try and see. I haven't really been able to tell too much of a difference. If I notice anything, I'll let you know on a future episode of the MacCast. But something else interesting about those tweeters is they have gold screws on them that attach them to the sides of the HomePod, and those screw posts are actually also doubling as the audio connectors. So this whole thing is layered. It's got this layered power supply all the way up to and through and including the giant woofer that is on the top of it that has a massive magnet. And it's that massive magnet that adds that heft and that weight to the HomePod. So just an incredible feat of engineering if you get in to look at this. And I encourage you to take a look at the iFixit teardown because it's pretty impressive. Some other things of note, the LEDs at the top that create the Siri animation, those are actually just RGB LEDs in a round matrix, and they're diffused to cause that color. So it doesn't look like there's any kind of legitimate LCD display under that. It really just is a series of LED lights. Whether or not they could create an actual pattern, it would have to be a very simple pattern. So don't expect that to display much, if anything. And the plus and minus symbols for the volume are really just cutouts that the white light from the LED shines through. So not a whole lot of sophistication there. You also have the A8 chip in there, which we knew about. They're suspecting it has 1 gigabyte of RAM, and it looks like the HomePod has 16 gigabytes of storage. I'm assuming that's mostly for audio caching, but that's a lot of storage in there for not a lot of functionality beyond the operating system, and again, maybe some cache and stuff like that. So very, very interesting. There was also a cost analysis done by Tech Insights this week, and they estimate that the cost to Apple for all of the components inside a HomePod, the raw component costs, are around $216. Any of these really need to be taken with a grain of salt because they don't, I think, typically account for the volume discounts that Apple is probably getting on components, but they estimate that Apple's making a margin of just about 38%. On each HomePod that's sold, and that's pretty low when you compare it to some of the margins Apple makes on some of their other products. And it's also considerably lower than the estimated 56 to 66% that other smart speaker makers like Amazon and Google are predicted to be getting on their products. So, you know, I think part of this is because I think Apple really views HomePod as an accessory that drives sales of their other products, and also, more importantly, sales of their services like Apple Music and iCloud, which are becoming a bigger and bigger portion of their annual revenue. So it kind of lends some insight into Apple's thinking behind HomePod. There have been reports recently of a few people having issues setting up their HomePod. It's the blank panel issue. So some people have went to set up the HomePod, which involves putting your iPhone or an iOS device near the HomePod. And then just like with AirPods, a little screen pops up. You get a little panel and it walks you through kind of a setup wizard. Well, the problem for some people was they would do that and it would just come up with a white blank screen. And what has happened, what the cause of the problem is that the first part of the setup asks you if you don't already subscribe to Apple Music or you don't have Apple Music, if you'd like to sign up for a 3-month free trial. But there's some people who have removed the music app because they just don't use it. If you use Spotify or some other service, Apple added in iOS 11 the ability to remove some of the default apps. So if you don't have the music app installed, that's when you get this blank screen problem. So if you've run into that problem, it is a real simple fix. All you need to do is go to the App Store and download the music app. And once you have that installed, restart the setup process with HomePod, and you should be fine. You don't have to sign up for the Apple Music trial. You don't even have to use Apple Music with your HomePod because you can AirPlay from other sources like Spotify and things like that. You can also have it work with your iTunes account or if you use iTunes Music Match. So there are other options. Just skip through that screen at that point, but you do need to have the music app installed at least for the initial setup. And then I would imagine you could delete the music app after that. So just something to note if you have run into that problem when setting up your new HomePod. Another kind of controversy that came up for HomePod this week was some reviewers noted the HomePod was leaving white rings on their wood furniture. So after setting the HomePod down on some wood surfaces, it would develop this white ring, which is pretty bad, especially if you have high-end furniture. It seems to be isolated to wood surfaces that were treated with either wax or oil coatings. So if you have a polyurethane surface, that seems to be okay. And what's happening here is the silicone base of the HomePod, the little rubber noise-isolating base, is reacting with the waxes or those oil coatings. And this is not just an issue for HomePod. It's really an issue for anything you would set on that surface. And as a matter of that uses silicone feet. And as a matter of fact, another reviewer noted that his Sonos Play One speakers were doing a similar kind of effect. Now, Apple confirmed that this actually is a possibility. You would have hoped they maybe would have put some messaging included in the HomePod box so that people didn't run into this issue, but it doesn't look like they did. They did say that the marks, if you remove the HomePod speaker, in most cases should fade out or improve over several days. If not, they recommend cleaning the surface with the manufacturer's suggested oiling method to try and remove the rings. Unfortunately, if that doesn't work, you're probably going to need to do some surface repairs on that wood surface. So not a great situation for Apple to be in once again. But again, it's not an isolated problem. It's not just an Apple problem. And I have a feeling, you know, most people with higher end wood surfaces, they worry about what they put on them. They don't just put anything on top of those surfaces and will generally try to protect them. Of course, some innovative accessory makers have already jumped in. Pad and Quill came out very quickly with a new leather HomePod coaster for $19.99. They're taking pre-orders right now. I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. So just know if you're buying a HomePod and you have higher-end wood furniture that is treated with a wax or oil coating, put something under your HomePod. Do not put the HomePod directly on that surface. And don't put actually anything, apparently, that uses a silicone base or silicone feet onto that surface. Probably other kinds of rubber or plastic materials could also be an issue, but specifically for HomePod, it's the silicone. And then finally, one last music-related story for Apple this week. Apple updated the Shazam app for the first time since they acquired the company. Has a couple new features in there that are pretty interesting. There is now a lyrics sync, so if you bring it up and have it listening for what song might be playing currently, it will actually kind of give you this little karaoke lyric sync thing, so you can sing along to the music. That's pretty neat and a lot of fun. They also offered up better display search results, all new track menu for providing access to all of the information the music service has on your track, and added easier ways to add songs, I think this isn't surprising, to Apple Music, your Apple Music playlists, but also to Spotify, and they still support Google Music as far as I can see. So they're not removing features. They're not, you know, pulling stuff away from Spotify, at least not yet, as some people thought they might do. But it looks like a nice little update. So if you're a Shazam user and like that app, grab the update and let us know what you think. But that is all the latest with HomePod and some of the Apple news this week. Bloomberg is reporting that starting with iOS 12, Apple is no longer going to focus on major new features of the operating system solely being released around the single 0.0 release. So this kind of plays into some news we heard about last week, I think also from Bloomberg, that Apple was kind of pulling back on some of the major new features for iOS 12 and actually focusing on more security and performance enhancements, more stability enhancements. And it's looking like now the thought moving forward is that they're not just going to try and dump a bunch of new features into the first release, you know, major 0.0 release of the operating systems. And this seems to be going for not only iOS, but all of the other operating systems across the board, that what they'll do is they'll bring out some new features, some big new features that they can focus on, but then also through the impending next point releases also add in new features when they're ready. So bigger new features will come out throughout the life cycle of that version of the operating system. And they're calling this a cultural shift in Apple's thinking, but I think it's one that's becoming more common in general in the software industry. This is actually something Adobe adopted, I think, with great success when they went to subscription with Creative Cloud. It was one of the reasons they said they were going to a subscription service so that they didn't have to do one big point release with a bunch of big new features every 12 to 18 months, that they could roll out features constantly throughout the year. And it really gives the software development teams an ability to focus on a small number of really big key features at any one given point. They can finish those up, do a really great job rolling those out, and then move on to the next thing. So I really like this philosophy, and I do hope this report is accurate. I hope it is something that Apple is adopting. Now, that doesn't mean they're not planning any big new features for iOS 12.0. We're starting to hear about some of the things that we might see, including the ability to use Animoji in FaceTime, so you can use Animoji on your FaceTime calls. Also, enhancements to the Do Not Disturb feature. Other future iOS updates we're already hearing about too is maybe the ability to run several windows in one app on the iPad, so sort of an expansion of multitasking, but not just multitasking between apps, but being able to multitask inside a single app with multiple windows. That will be a nice new enhancement, and that is supposedly coming maybe in 2019 in a future update. There's also some planned macOS updates for this year. We've already heard about Project Marzipan, which is designed to make porting of iOS apps for developers much easier, so they can take their iOS apps and port them over into Mac apps, which will be great for the Mac, meaning we could potentially see more software showing up on our Macs. And I would fully expect to hear something about that at the Worldwide Developer Conference, which should be coming up in June. We're also hearing about something, an app codenamed Liberty, which is bringing the Home app to the Mac. So the ability to see all your HomeKit devices and control those, including the HomePod, which is a HomeKit device now, coming to the Mac probably in the next major release sometime this year. And if you're not a fan of the notch that is in the iPhone X, you may not be happy to hear this next rumor. It's looking like we're getting a little bit more evidence that the notch is here to stay for a while, because Apple has informed developers this week that all new apps submitted to the App Store after April 2018 must support the iPhone X's Super Retina display, and that includes the little horns, the little ears that are on either side of the notch. The policy is going to apply just to new apps for now. They have not apparently set a deadline for updates to existing apps, but that is the case moving forward. And when we're hearing about new models of the iPhone, it's sounding like they all are going to adopt Apple's True Depth camera system, which would presume that that stuff is going to be in the notch, at least for the near future. Also related to this policy, all new apps must be built against the iOS 11 SDK. And those are some changes for developers that seem to indicate, yeah, the notch is going to be around at least for a little while. A recent TrendForce report says that Apple now ranks in fourth place for global laptop shipments. That is up from fifth place the last time they did this report. The report says that Apple's new MacBook Pro helped the company increase shipments by 18% in 2017, achieving the highest growth rate among all notebook brands. Their market share rose to 9.6% in the year, up almost 2% from 2016, and TrendForce thinks that the trend will continue, no pun intended there, sorry about that, into 2018, achieving double-digit percentage for Apple growth in the notebook market by the end of next year. They're expecting, I think, about 10.6% growth in 2018, or market share in 2018, which would be the highest Apple has ever achieved. And I don't think they've been up in the notebook segment above double digits. So that would be a big milestone for Apple. So iPhone or Mac laptop sales going very, very well for Apple, even though in general, I think all of desktop and notebook shipments are generally on the decline as more and more people rely on larger iPhones or larger phones, smartphones and tablets and things like that. On the iPhone sales front for 2018, things are looking good there as well. KGI analyst Ming-Chi Kuo thinks that Apple's update to the iPhone 8 and the 8 Plus is going to be very popular among consumers. This is the update where he says Apple is going to produce a 6.1-inch LCD version of the iPhone, and it's actually going to be replacing both the 8 and the 8 Plus because he expects the updates to the iPhone 10 to be two new models, a 5.8-inch model and a massive 6.5-inch model, both using OLED displays. But the reason he thinks that the LCD 6.1-inch model is going to be a little bit more popular is that it's going to have an accessible price point, maybe as low as $699 US, and with the lower cost, it is going to have some compromises beyond the lack of an OLED display. For example, he thinks they will use aluminum instead of stainless steel for the frame. Some reports have also claimed that it might not include 3D touch and will likely only have a single lens eyesight camera, although it is, as I mentioned earlier, expected to still have the true depth camera system, Face ID support, and no home button. So it's going to adopt a similar design to the iPhone X, just with a few different components that are going to bring the cost down and also the price point down. But that is going to be good because Kuo thinks that it will end up being the most popular model of iPhone that Apple will sell in 2018. He thinks Apple could sell as many as 100 million units, and that would account for about 50% of the total iPhone shipments he expects Apple to make in 2018. Just for some comparisons, Apple sold a total of 77.3 million iPhones just last quarter. So 100 million might not sound like a lot, but for comparison, Kuo says he expects iPhone X shipments to be around 62 million units by the time Apple replaces them with a new version this fall. So that would be a considerably larger number than the total number of iPhone Xs he expects Apple to ship in a year. And also, remember, it's also expected that Apple will deliver an updated 5.8-inch iPhone X model plus a new, you know, plus that new plus-size 6.5-inch iPhone X later this year. So between all of those different models, it's looking like he's expecting, because if 100 million units is half the total, he's expecting Apple to ship almost 200 million plus units of iPhones in 2018, which I think would be a unit shipment record. So no signs of iPhone sales slowing anytime soon, at least if you want to believe Ming-Chi Kuo. And he's a pretty good analyst to believe, in my opinion. He's pretty on top of this stuff, so we like him. Strategy Analytics has also reported that last quarter, Apple captured a record 51% share of the worldwide smartphone revenue. They estimate that Apple's revenue was three times that of their next nearest competitor, who was Samsung. So Apple continuing to dominate the revenues for smartphones. Basically, Apple accounted for more smartphone revenue than the rest of the entire industry combined for the quarter, which is very impressive. So, you know, regardless of how many units Apple sells versus, say, Android phones, they're raking in the dough more than anybody else. And that is good news for their bottom line, good news for their stockholders, and also good news just in general for the health of the company. So anytime you hear some of these reports that say Apple is doomed, just remember, even as sales go down, profits go up, you know, sales in terms of units. And that's not necessarily a bad place to be in. As I told you at the top of the show, and as I've been saying for a while now, I think we're at the point where not a week can go by when we won't hear about some new original content programming that Apple has picked up, and this week is no exception. Once again, Variety is reporting that Apple is developing another drama series. This time, it's supposedly based on the early life and career of NBA superstar Kevin Durant. The series is reportedly titled Swagger and is inspired by Durant's youth basketball experiences. The show will reportedly look at Durant and also cover the Amateur Athletic Union organization that he helped found and look at the lives of the players, families, and coaches who are involved in that program. The show will be produced by Brian Grazer and Ron Howard's Imagine Television, along with Durant's own 35 Media. Reggie Rock By the Wood, who collaborated with Imagine on the Fox limited series Shots Fired and also co-wrote the Notorious B.I.G. biopic called Notorious, will reportedly also serve as a writer on the project. I have to say that I also do wonder if the fact that Durant plays for the Golden State Warriors and the fact that Apple's Eddie Q is a massive Golden State Warriors fan had anything to do with Apple wanting to pick up this project. You know, I think there might be a little connection there. At the very least, I'm sure Eddie Q is very happy that Durant is on board to produce something for Apple. And then one other bit of entertainment news this week that I find a little bit odd. Apple has reportedly chosen to renew Carpool Karaoke for a second season. You know, I tried to like this. I tried to watch it. It just didn't really click for me. It obviously must be clicking for someone, at least enough for Apple to think it's worth renewing for a second season. But yes, I think we're all still a little bit confused about who is actually watching Carpool Karaoke. If you are and you love it, more power to you. I'd love to hear from you, too. What do you like about it? What are you enjoying about it? And what am I missing? Why should I be watching it? Maybe I need to go back and review some of those episodes. But, man, it was a little bit rough to watch for me. I think it lost a little bit of its magic in the transition from the thing that it used to be under James Corden as this sort of simple little short piece, and Apple trying to convert it into an actual 30-minute show. I'm not sure it really clicked. At least it didn't click with me. So there you have it. It is being picked up. So if you are a fan, you don't have to worry about it going away, at least not for the next year. And then finally, in the news for this week, Apple has confirmed that there is an Indian character bug in their operating systems, and this affects messaging apps, not just Apple's messages apps, but also messaging apps like WhatsApp and Twitter and maybe a few others. What's happening is that if a certain Telugu Indian character is sent to one of your devices in the messaging app, it could cause it to crash, and it's a bit hard to recover from, and it does seem to impact both macOS, watchOS, tvOS, and iOS. Some reports are also claiming that in the case of iOS, it can require a DFU or a connected to iTunes reset to actually be able to fix it. If it happens to you, if you do get hit by this character, one bit of advice if you're on iOS is wait for it to crash and do a full Springboard reboot where it comes back fully to the iOS Springboard or your application launcher. Don't try to force restart it while it's resetting, because that's what could possibly put you in this loop requiring you to connect it to iTunes to recover. So don't do that. Again, the crash can happen in almost any messaging app. The chances that you are going to get a message with this specific character, unless someone now is trying to deliberately do it to you, is probably slim. And again, Apple is already aware of the problem, and they already have fixes in place in the upcoming updates for iOS 11.3, for macOS 10.13.4, watchOS 4.3, and tvOS 11.3. So as soon as those updates are out, this little bug should be fixed and you shouldn't have to worry about it anymore. But it's interesting that this kind of bug keeps cropping up. And this is the second one that has to do, I think, with a specific character being able to cause messaging apps to crash. on Mac OS. So just a weird isolated thing. I won't read too much into it. I don't think it's an epidemic problem for Apple, but it is frustrating that they're having to deal with it now a second time. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Backblaze. Look, if you have not added an offsite backup solution to your backup regimen by now, there is no time better than at this moment to start. Because I can tell you, one of the worst emails that I get here at the MacCast is the one that starts out, "I know you always tell us to back up, but..." And that's just an email I don't want to get. It's something that shouldn't happen, and Backblaze is the perfect solution for this. They provide unlimited cloud backup for Macs, PC, and PCs for just $5 a month. That means you can have all your memories, your critical files and documents, your movies, your music, everything kept safe for just $60 a year. It is so worth it. Hard drive recovery software, I will tell you right now, starts at least $100, and you're not guaranteed to get your stuff back. Recovery services are even more expensive. If you have to send it out, you're talking several hundreds, if not thousands of dollars to recover your data. So spend the $5 a month. It is so worth it. Over 20 billion files have been restored to Backblaze customers. That's a lot of returned documents and data and a lot of hassle saved. And what I love about Backblaze, beyond the price, is it's by far the easiest solution that I have ever used. They have a great, easy-to-use native interface. It's a system preference pane and a menu bar item. It works really well. It's fast, a lot faster than some of the other backup services that I've tried, and you can tweak it. And they even have this really cool bandwidth checker at backblaze.com/speedtest that will actually calculate how long it's going to take to upload your data at the max speed, and you can adjust things if you throttle your settings. So you can play around with that and you can get an idea of how long it's going to take to back up your data. And they offer many ways to restore. You can do it through the app. You can restore just one file at a time or all of them. And best of all, if you do unfortunately get into a critical situation, they offer restore by mail. So you can have a hard drive with all of your data sent to you overnighted via FedEx. And they also have a return option. So if you return that drive to them, you can get a full refund for the cost of that drive. So they'll charge you for the drive, but if you return it to them, you get that money back. So it's just a win-win all the way around. And best of all, you can receive a fully featured 15-day free trial. So you can try it out. Backblaze.com/MacCast. Go there. Sign up, download it, play with it, start protecting yourself today. Don't wait, because I don't want to get any more of those emails. You really have no excuse for not backing up your stuff now. They make it so easy. So make sure you visit backblaze.com/MacCast so they know where you came from and continue to support the show. And of course, don't forget, they also offer business backup. So if you already use Backblaze at home, tell your sysadmin at work to go to backblaze.com/MacCast and hit the business backup options and take a look at that, because they offer the same awesome service with admin tools using Backblaze groups. So make sure you visit backblaze.com/MacCast, and a big thank you to them for their support of the show. One of the things we've been talking about quite a bit now here on the MacCast is how to give remote support to friends and family. You know, a lot of us are the support team when it comes to Mac and Apple products for our relatives, our parents, our children, maybe, you know, who knows, you might have to support someone over the phone, and that can get a little bit tricky. A lot of times it's a lot easier if maybe you can see their screen or they can see your screen, something like that. And we've been talking about different solutions for that. A great one is TeamViewer version 13. I told you about that on the last episode of the MacCast, so if you didn't hear that, go back and listen to it. But this week, a MacCast listener, Sonal, pointed out that you could also use screen sharing through the Messages app, specifically for Mac support. That's pretty easy to do. But then you could also have an iOS user connect their device to their Mac with a USB cable and use the QuickTime movie recording option to have them display their device screen on their Mac. And then because you're giving them remote, quote unquote, Mac support, you could see that as well. And it's pretty easy to do. So what you do is, if both people get into a messages conversation, what you do is you click on the conversation in the list, in the messages list on the left, and then click on the details option. And you should then see a little screen sharing icon. It looks like two little stacked screens, and you can click on that and then either ask them to share their screen with you or share your screen with them. So in this case, you're probably going to have them, you're going to want to ask them to share their screen. And what will happen is they'll get a little prompt saying, hey, this person wants to share your screen. Is this okay? Once they accept that request, then you'll have a Mac screen sharing thing going on, and you should be able to see their Mac screen. Once you have their Mac screen up, ask them to connect their iPhone to their Mac using the USB to Lightning cable, and then open up the QuickTime application. And then inside QuickTime, you go under the File menu under New Movie Recording. Now, there is an option that says New Screen Recording. Don't use that. It would seem like you would want to do the screen recording thing, but that's only going to let them record their Mac screen. You need to say New Movie Recording. And then when the New Movie Recording dialogue comes up, click the little arrow to the right of the record button. It's a little down arrow, looks like a carrot symbol. Click on that, and then you should be able to see the connected iOS device. Select that as the camera source, and once you do that, the iOS's display will show up on the Mac screen. And because you are remotely viewing the Mac, you should be able to see the iPhone screen now, and you can have them then use their iPhone to go through whatever the trouble is, and you'll be able to see their screen on your Mac screen. And you'll be doing it all with built-in software that's built right into your Mac. And another thing to note is, more specifically for the Mac sharing screen sharing thing, is once you're in sharing mode, the sharing application will also have a little button in the upper left that allows you to click and control the remote Mac. So you can actually take control of a remote Mac. You won't be able to do anything in terms of controlling the iOS device, but you will be able to walk through Mac menus and things like that if you want to. So, and again, I think it will send them a request saying so-and-so wants to be able to control your screen. Is that okay? And once they accept that, then you would have remote control over the Mac. So just a couple other ways to give remote support to friends and family who are using Apple and Mac and iOS devices. And thanks, Sonal, for pointing out that other option. Now, a little HomePod tip that came up. I think I found this one over on the Mac Observer. What happens if you need to take your HomePod off of your current network and take it to another network and you need to reset it up? How do you do that? Well, one way you could do it is go into the Home app before you leave your house on your iOS device and reset the HomePod, put it back into its default state. And right now it does appear that if you want to change the network that your HomePod is connected to, the only way to do it is to actually reset it. So in order to reset it, typically, if you're going to do it through the app, the Home app, you need to be currently on the same network that the HomePod is on. Well, what if you didn't do that? You left home, but you took your HomePod, say, to a vacation house or to a friend's house, and you forgot to remove it or reset it before leaving your home network. What are you going to do in that case? And it turns out you actually can manually reset the HomePod without being connected to it. So what you do is you need to unplug the HomePod, plug it back in, which is probably going to happen when you take it off your home network and bring it someplace else. But that's the first step. And then what you need to do is press and hold the top of your HomePod, so, you know, the touch-sensitive display that's on the top, press and hold on that, and keep pressing it even when Siri starts to do her little spinning light show thing. And keep holding and wait until Siri announces that your HomePod is about to be reset. Don't even lift your finger then. Keep holding. And then wait until you hear a series of three beeps. At that point, you'll be done. The HomePod should be reset. And you can now bring an iOS device near the HomePod. And it should restart and start the whole process of setting up the HomePod. and then you can connect it to whatever new network you need to connect it to, and away you go. So that's how you reset a HomePod if you haven't done it before leaving the house. And again, thanks to Mac Observer for pointing that out, because that's not a real obvious a trick, I don't think. Another thing that I ran across this week that I found very interesting, and actually I found it most interesting in light of some of the experiences I've been having with using voice control to control music more in my house now that I have the HomePod here in my office. Benjamin Mayo, who normally writes for 9 to 5 Mac, wrote a great piece up about his Apple Music first impressions. So he's not really an Apple Music user, but he started using it with the HomePod, and he wrote up this great piece on his personal blog, and I'll link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, that highlights what I think is a pretty big issue with how Apple Music and iTunes categorizes albums. And the crux of the problem, and the thing that Benjamin noticed, was that all types of albums in the Apple Music ecosystem are treated basically equally. And that means like things like EPs, singles, special albums, deluxe albums, originals, live concert albums. They're all just termed albums in the Apple Music ecosystem. And the problem with this is this typically means one of two things. You either will not find a song because you don't own, say, the deluxe album, you own the standard album. This was something that Benjamin was running into. He had the standard album from a certain artist, not the deluxe version. And when he would ask to play a particular track, the HomePod would report that it couldn't do it. He didn't have that album, or it couldn't find that music. The other thing that tends to happen, and this one is more typically what I've been experiencing, is that you get the wrong version of a song. You get the version that's off of the live album or the deluxe album or some special compilation that the artist did with another artist or something like that. You get this weird, odd version, not the original album version that you're expecting to get. And this also very often happens with specific tracks. You ask for a song, but if you fail to specify the album or the artist, you get odd alternate versions. You might get cover versions. It's really, really annoying. And I think anybody who's used Apple Music for a while has probably experienced this. And I know I've heard from a number of you about this issue. And, you know, Apple should be smart enough. Its music system should be smart enough to know that 90% of the time when someone is asking for a particular track from a particular artist, you want the original version from the original album that it was released on, not some weird off version. And, you know, at the very least, if there are multiple versions of the same track available, the system should be able to ask you, which version do you want? Do you want the, I noticed I have an EP version and I have a special version, or do you want the original version? I don't know the best way to handle it, but at the very least, it should, the default should be that original version from the original album that it was released on, at least in my opinion. And if you want to see an example of where this problem exists, just search for any artist on iTunes, one of your favorite artists, and then click on their album list and look at all of the albums that are in there. It's not going to be, and this was what Benjamin pointed out in his piece, it's not going to be just the main album releases, but every album that that artist's music is on, including things like soundtracks and compilations. So if there's some version that was just a one-off on a soundtrack, that is going to show up as an album attributed to that artist. And it's just odd. It shouldn't happen that way. It shouldn't be that way. And Apple has a real problem with this. And it's only been more emphasized by the fact that if you have a HomePod, you're having to call up all this stuff by voice. And there's no way to kind of look at an album cover or look at what's being returned and determine, is this the correct version? Is this the thing that I asked for? And very often, again, it's not. It's fine when you're doing playlists and things like that. I had this experience. I was trying to get a certain track off a certain album, and what I ultimately ended up having to do was go into iTunes on my Mac and actually add the album from the Apple Music site into my own iTunes collection. And then once I did that, that seemed to kind of jog the HomePod's memory, if that's such a thing. Basically, it let it know, oh, he wants the thing that's out of his Apple Music library now, not just some random thing out of my massive Apple Music collection up here in the cloud. And I was able to actually get the thing that I want. And this really, again, Benjamin points this out in his piece, this shouldn't be that hard. The ability to kind of separate the main core albums from an artist from all of these ancillary extra versions and things like that shouldn't be that hard. And the root of the problem probably dates back to Apple's original conversion of all the audio CD stuff back in the day, right? They went down a path. So a lot of these things feel like they're kind of legacy holdover stuff from an older day, an older iTunes. And it's about time now that especially Apple is getting into more of this music stuff that they need to clean up this categorization. So I'm curious what you think on this. I thought this was a great point and something that needed to be brought up for discussion in the community. You know, like cleaning up the metadata, making Apple Music a lot smarter about factoring in the things that people are really asking for, right? And I hear the complaint a lot. I hear from a lot of people that say, oh, iTunes or Apple Music messed up my music collection. In a lot of cases, that's not what's happening here. It did its match thing. It has the information. It has the right stuff in iTunes. But when you're trying to recall it, especially over voice or through Siri or something like that, it's delivering the wrong, odd, weird versions of tracks. And there's not a lot of control and there's not a lot of things that you can do to get it to give you the thing that you actually want. So it needs to be fixed. It needs to be made a lot smarter. And again, I thought it was a great piece from Benjamin, and I'll link to it in the show notes. So take a look, go read it, see what he's talking about, and then let me know what you think. Give me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. All right, I want to finish the show today with some interesting feedback and unfortunately some frustrating stories from a couple of MacCast listeners with their experience in getting batteries replaced on their iPhones. A lot of people, because Apple has initiated their $29, £25, you know, it's different prices in different regions, but because they've initiated this low-cost battery replacement, a lot of you are running out and wanting to get your batteries replaced. And we've had a few people with some good experiences, but more and more, I'm hearing some people with some frustrating experiences. So this time around, I got an email from a MacCast listener in the Netherlands. And he gave a story that sounds like it's happening to not just him, but a few other people, because I've heard a few similar stories. Sander basically wanted to get his iPhone 6 battery replaced, and he spent the time, he contacted Apple support, he set up everything in advance because he knew he was going to have an hour and a half, basically have to do an hour and a half of traveling to get to the Apple store in Amsterdam to actually do his replacement. And he knew this was going to be a thing. He kind of planned and made a day of it, said, I'm going to go in, I'm going to spend some time in Amsterdam, and I'm going to do some things while I wait for this to happen. And all was going very, very well. He went in the morning, they checked him in, they were all ready to do his repair because he had, you know, set up things in advance. He was going to have about a 5-hour wait for them to do the repair, but he was going to enjoy the day in Amsterdam, eating and seeing some sights and stuff like that, and then come back and pick up his iPhone. And everything was going great until he came back that evening to pick up the iPhone, as he thought, with a new battery installed in it. And he was going to take that away and, you know, job done. Well, he got there and it wasn't that way. Unfortunately, they told him they had not replaced the battery because when they got in to do the battery replacement, they noticed that there was water damage. The little sensor inside had been tripped. And at that point, they told him your only option is to purchase an out of warranty replacement, and that's going to cost you 350 euros. So he went in for a battery and was now faced with having a $350 bill for his efforts, and also having spent, you know, basically what amounts to a 3-hour round trip to not get the thing done that he had originally set up. So needless to say, very frustrating. And the problem was is that even though the moisture sensor had supposedly tripped, he had no problems with his iPhone other than the battery when he brought it in. It was working perfectly fine. He had no issues with it. And he even at that point said, hey, can I just buy the battery from you? And then I'll take it home. I'll do the replacement. You don't need to do the replacement. Of course, he was told, no, they don't sell batteries. They only do the battery replacement. Oddly, I don't even think they gave him the option to pay full price to get the battery replacement. It was just, okay, look, the sensor tripped. We can't do the battery replacement. And as far as the water damage, he didn't remember at the time that he was in the store, but he did write to me in his email that when he returned home, he remembered that 3 years earlier, the iPhone was briefly dunked in a Swedish lake. So he had dropped it into some water. He dried it out and it had worked fine since then. So it had been working fine for 3 years, despite having tripped the little sensor that was inside. He only needed the battery replacement. So he wrote to share his story, but he also wrote in to ask, hey, what can I do in this situation? You know, what are my options? And Sander, I would say your best option right now is to get your own battery replacement. And in my opinion, probably the best place to get that is you can get a battery replacement kit. They are charging about the same price as Apple, I think right around 25 euro, and they actually do have an EU store. So if you go to eustore.ifixit.com, you can get a replacement kit for an iPhone 6. And what's great about that kit is they include not just the battery for that price, but also all of the tools that you're going to need to be able to do the replacement yourself on your iPhone 6. And then you can follow their great iFixit guides to actually be able to perform the replacement yourself. So it really stinks that you're going to have to do it on your own, but you should be able to do it. It's not incredibly difficult if you're not too concerned about things like that, if you don't get too worried about cracking open an iPhone. But I've done it myself, done repairs on iPhones myself, and it shouldn't be too terribly difficult. So that's probably the route that I would take at this point. But I also want to use your experience as a little bit bigger story for the community, because it seems like apparently Apple will not service an iPhone if the liquid contact indicator, the LCI, has been tripped. And I think since about 2006, all iPhones do have these little sensors. Apple actually has a support article about it. I will link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. And the big reason to take a look at that article is that it does show where the liquid contact indicator is in every model of iPhone. Now, on most of them, it does appear to be through the SIM card slot. So if you pop out the SIM card tray and then shine a light inside your iPhone, what you're looking for is you're looking to see if you see a bright red line or some sort of red dot. If you do see that in there, it would indicate that your iPhone has sustained some sort of water damage. And that's the thing that Apple is looking at and saying to Sander that, hey, this has been tripped. Obviously, the phone was in water at some point, and we can't replace your battery. So if you've ever suspected or you think that you've dropped your iPhone in water and you're thinking about a battery replacement, you might want to check this yourself before you take the time to go all the way into Apple, only to find out that they're not going to replace your battery. And in case you're wondering, Apple does claim that humidity or temperature changes cannot trip the sensor, although I know some people who will debate on that, but Apple says no, it won't trip in those sorts of situations. It will only trip if there's actually been water damage. So take a look at that and consider that before you go in. But I think, you know, Sander's experience just also illustrates something else that I've been hearing, and that is this general confusion and sort of a widely varying array of reports and experiences for many of you when you go in for the battery replacement process. I'm hearing from many people where it went completely smoothly, but I'm also hearing from others who have experienced problems. People like Paul, and Paul wrote in and shared this battery replacement experience with us.
Hi Adam, it's Paul Adkins here from the UK. I thought I'd chip in with my experience of this battery thing with Apple. When I knew about it, I decided to contact them and contacted the technical support by phone. And they agreed to run diagnostics remotely, which they did. And that told them that my phone had done 420 cycles and they expected the average battery life to be 500. So they thought it was well worth having the battery replaced. They told me that they could either send me a box and I could send it to them and they would fix it and send it back to me, but I would be without the phone for a few days. And the alternative was to go into a Genius bar and to get them to do it. They suggested I made an appointment with the Genius bar, check that the battery was in stock, and then I could go and sort it. Well, I made an appointment with the Genius bar online, and there was a message window where I could write about the problem. So I explained everything and what the technician had told me and hoped that they would call me back. I didn't hear anything, so I contacted them, and they explained that the message window was just for their technicians to check immediately before seeing somebody what the problem might be. So I explained what the technician had said to me and asked if they could order a battery for me, and they said, no, you have to come in to the store for us to check your phone. And I said, well, there isn't anything wrong with the phone. The phone is going great, but I would just like to replace the battery for £25. And they said, no, you have to come in so we can look at the phone. I said, I live an hour and a half drive away from the store. And they said, well, you still have to come in. If we have the battery in stock, yeah, then we would change it. If we don't, then you'll need to come back again. So I said, yeah, but if I'm going to drive an hour and a half, I don't want to get there to find you don't have the battery in stock. So given that Apple are agreeing to replace the batteries, whatever, as long as I'm paying the money, why do you need to see the phone? He said, well, there might be something else wrong with the phone. And I said, well, that's my problem. As far as I'm concerned at the moment, there's nothing wrong with the phone. But he insisted that the only way around this was for me to drive an hour and a half into the city to take it into the store for them to look at it, to probably tell me that I needed to go away and come back again on another day. So I complained about this, and basically they said, well, we'll get someone to contact you. And I went through Apple complaints on the phone, and they got somebody from the store to give me a call. And this person said, you know, I'm going to take ownership of this case. This is what you need to do. She then proceeded to give me the phone number of the Apple ordinary technical support, which is the one that I had found in the first place. And I explained that if I phoned this number, I would end up speaking to a technician who would probably tell me the same thing that I had been told in the first place. So I was getting nowhere. And finally, they did agree that they would actually make sure that they had a battery in stock. And then I listened to your show, and actually you made very good sense that if the battery is working okay at the moment, it would be better to wait until the end of the year. So basically I rang them back and said, give the battery to somebody else. But even then, I still wanted to make sure that they would agree to tell me if they had batteries in stock eventually when I go in, on the day I go in, so I don't have to do more than a three-hour round trip. So that's my experience, which is pretty poor, really. It seems to be that they seem to be all over the place with this battery situation. But the one thing is, they will not just get a battery ready. They insist, well, certainly in my experience in the UK, they insist on seeing the phone physically and testing it physically before they'll even agree to order a new battery. So that's my experience. Not so good. Show is great. Thanks, Adam. Signing off.
Hey, Paul, that is really odd. Your experience, I don't know if I have any other word for it. It's odd. I wish I could say it was unusual. I don't think it's necessarily unusual, because I also got an email this week from Carlos in Argentina, and he had a similar bad experience with Apple chat support. He was trying to do exactly the same thing as you, make sure that before he trucked all the way down to the Apple store that they were going to have the battery for him, and only to get all the way down there and find out they didn't have a battery and they were going to tell him to come back. So I've had a few people who have had that same exact experience. Some people even saying, I thought they pre-ordered a battery and I got to the store only to find out that they didn't. What's really odd, in my opinion, about your experience, Paul, is you seem to have taken the steps that many other MacCast listeners have told me about, where you ring up phone support and they run a remote iPhone diagnostic And they determine that, yes, you can get a new battery. And just like they did for you, they would be able to then order a battery and have it ready for you to when you come in. I guess they didn't do that for you, but other people have said they've been able to do that for them. And that test, that remote diagnostic test, is the exact test that they're telling you they would want you to come into the store to have you run. Now, that being said, I've had several people tell me that while they did run the remote iPhone diagnostic, also when they got in for their actual battery replacement, the one where they had already pre-ordered the battery for them, they still wanted to run exactly the same test at the Genius Bar, which did feel a little bit redundant, but at least in their case, they already had the battery and they were going to do the replacement anyway. So, you know, the fact that they said they have to run that diagnostic in the store after rerunning the remote diagnostic or already running the remote diagnostic, that just seems really weird. I don't know why Apple wants to do that, but that does seem to be a policy. So that, you know, them telling you that is kind of half the story, I think. But what's really weird is that they should be able to pre-order the battery and have it shipped to the store. At least that's something they do here in the U.S. I've had many people say they did that, and then they were contacted by the store when the battery was in and ready to be replaced. And so my first couple of thoughts are, well, maybe it varies from country to country. I don't know why they would be doing that. But then I also thought, well, maybe the issue is that technically your battery didn't fail, right? It wasn't failing the diagnostic test. So are they treating maybe people who actually truly need the battery replacement now differently than those who don't need it immediately? And so I thought, you know what? I need to test this myself because I've only been hearing all these stories through the community. I've never actually tested it myself. So I went on to Apple's chat and I pretended like I wanted to get a battery replacement for an iPhone 6 that I have. And I specifically asked, hey, can I pre-order the battery, have it shipped to an Apple store? And I was very clear about the things that I wanted them to do. Can I have you order a battery for me now, have it shipped to the store so that it is ready and there for when I get there to be replaced? And I was told, absolutely, yes. In fact, they explained the entire process to me, and I will share that with all of you. Here's what they said. They said they needed to know the iPhone serial number, so as long as I had that, I gave that to them, and then they would forward that serial number on to Apple's battery reservation team, and that's specifically what this agent called them. So there is a team, at least for US, I don't know if chat support is separate by region, but there is apparently a battery reservation team. So a team of people that will reserve a battery for you. And they said once they forward that information on to them, they would reserve a battery for me and I would receive an email within 3 to 5 days to confirm that the battery had been ordered. So it takes them 3 to 5 days to just order the battery. And then they said that email would also indicate when they expected the battery to arrive and be delivered at my Apple store. And at that point, the store would contact me to set up an appointment to come in and have the actual battery replacement done. But the battery would be there and available and ready and set aside for my specific battery replacement. So this is something that they are doing. I don't know why there's confusion or why some people are having a different experience. The only thing I can think of is, one, maybe it's different for different countries. You would hope that that would not be the case. Or it's possible that the agent just isn't understanding, or maybe the right phrasing or the right questions aren't being asked. But it sounds like to me, Paul, in your case, you were very specific about what you wanted them to do. So all the advice that I can offer at this point, without knowing the actual inner workings inside Apple beyond what I learned by, you know, doing this tech support chat, is I would make sure that you use the words, I want you to order a battery for me now and have it shipped to my Apple store before I go in for the replacement. And I also mentioned in my thing that I had heard they were extremely backordered, and you may even want to say to the agent, I've heard that you have a battery reservation team. Can I talk to them, or can you forward my request onto the battery reservation team if you're not getting anywhere with the agent? I also think that, you know, maybe not using chat support, because text, you know, texting over chat and stuff like that, it can get a little bit confusing. I had success with the agent I was working with, but maybe calling directly over the phone and actually talking to someone at AppleCare can get you better results as well. It really shouldn't be this hard. It shouldn't be this difficult for people to get a battery replacement. But I definitely think you want to, and I'm going to stick by this, you still want to, in advance, make sure they pre-order you a battery at this point if you want to get one now. Because as far as I know, and as far as I'm being told, these battery replacements are extremely back-ordered. Do not think that you can go just walk into an Apple store and get a battery replaced. I know some people are having luck doing that, but that is really a roll of the dice at this point, in my opinion. Whether or not they'll have a specific battery for your specific model phone is really iffy. So I would make sure you pre-order in advance, and don't take no for an answer, because it does sound like this is an option, although some agents apparently don't realize it. So maybe it's a training issue inside Apple. I don't really know. And if you happen to work as at a Genius Bar, or you're in another country and you're a Genius, I know you're, you know, a lot of you aren't technically allowed to talk to press or media, but maybe if you could somehow send us a secret message some other way, I guarantee you, you have, anonymity of the press. I don't have to disclose my sources to anyone if they come around asking, and I will not. So, you know, feel free to somehow get in contact and let us know if we're misunderstanding the situation. But again, with talking directly with the chat agent that I talked to just today, this should be something that's possible, and it shouldn't be that difficult. So good luck out there. Continue to share your experiences with me. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. If you want to check out their great applications, PDF Pen, Disk Label, Text Expander, also Text Expander for iOS, and PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus, you can get more information and details on all of their great software by going to smilesoftware.com/podcast. If you want to support the MacCast, I would love to have you as a MacCast Patreon. You can check out our Patreon campaign over at patreon.com/MacCast. All of that money is going to go to help support and pay for costs here at the MacCast. And also, if you sign up to become a Patreon, you get a few extra bonuses and benefits. You can join our MacCast Slack channel and chat with other members of the MacCast community. We've got a great growing Slack community, and we'd love to have you join us there. So check out details on that, patreon.com/MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, if you have comments, questions, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I've talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you want to follow me on social media, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can also check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or join the MacCast Google Plus community. You'll find them at google.com/+MacCast. That's google.com/+MacCast. That's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.